Welcome to Radioactive Magazine. We will be speaking with Nicholas J.S. Davies about his new book with Medea Benjamin, War in Ukraine, Making Sense of a Senseless Conflict, published by OR Books, which is the only place I found that offered a Kindle edition. Can you start with a brief overview of the most important points in your book?
Yeah, well, it's a short book, about 200 pages, and has six or seven chapters. And we go over basically, there's three chapters that are really narrative, how 2014 set the stage for what has the crisis that has now unfolded and the Russian invasion, chapter called The Success and Failure of the Minsk Accords, because, you know, we explain how the Minsk Accords did actually bring a fairly successful ceasefire to the civil war in Ukraine, but the failure to implement the political aspects of the agreement meant that the civil war was still brewing there and never completely resolved. And that also, and the US played a part in that, and which we explore in the book. And then, of course, we come to the Russian invasion. The other chapters are, there's a chapter on NATO expansion and why that was just a foreign policy expert said at the time, a policy error of historic proportions that was bound to destabilize Europe. And then we have a chapter on information warfare, a chapter on the impact of the sanctions that the US and the EU have imposed on Russia. And we have a chapter on the dire danger of nuclear war. And that's really the span of the book. The publisher asked us for a short primer on the war in Ukraine and how we got into this crisis, and that's what we've done.
Oh,
and the book
great.
Is War in Ukraine, Making Sense of a Senseless Conflict.
So did I understand correctly that you're absolutely not trying to excuse anything that Putin has done, but only to help understand, and that Putin might have felt that he had to act when he did, because his security situation could have been worse if he had waited?
Yes, I mean, that sums up what appears to be the thinking of President Putin and the Russian government. Frankly, we're not terribly comfortable with the personalization and demonization with which all of the Western propaganda sort of says Putin, Putin, Putin. Russia is a country like the United States and others. Its government, obviously, there are different factions in the government. There's huge military bureaucracy too. Huge intelligence bureaucracy, and all of this obviously feeds into actual Russian foreign and military policy. Putin is the president, as Biden is the president here. So to some extent, the final decisions on these things rest with those two men, and President Zelensky in Ukraine too, of course. But all of them make their decisions based on what others are telling them. So these are institutional policies and institutional problems, and in fact, a massive institutional crisis now for us and them and the whole world.
There's a recent book on the coming conflict with China that says that China may start a war soon because they believe their security situation could be worse if they wait. Your comment?
Well, the same logic could ultimately at some point apply to China. It might not, because in fact, China is a growing power. They did not, as they grew and as they pulled 800 million of their people out of poverty, they did not immediately try to compete militarily with the United States, but they are the second largest military, have the second largest military budget in the world, and they clearly take defending their country very seriously. And as with Russia, the US has either blindly or deliberately stumbled into classic security dilemmas with and placed both of these countries in security dilemmas by building up huge military forces surrounding them.
What do you think the Biden administration should do today or in the near future about these issues?
Well, I mean, the first priority right now, really has to be getting back to the negotiating table. First of all, for Ukraine and Russia, I'm not sure whether a U.S. role in that can be helpful. It is a question of whether the U.S. wants to be helpful or intends to be helpful. Unfortunately, we have a dreadful history of the U.S. getting involved in crises around the world and being extremely unhelpful, making things worse, and trying to take advantage of the situation. So in a way, I would be more reassured to see Ukraine and Russia sitting down together as they did in March. And when they reached a 15-point framework agreement that was reported in mid-March, and as President Zelensky announced to his people on national TV and reassured them that he was not going to give anything away that they would not want him to give away, and reassured them that there would be a referendum throughout the country before whatever agreement was made was finalized and took effect. And so that all they got really far, a long way down the road in trying to resolve this in March. And by all accounts, it was the United States and the United Kingdom who intervened to say, we want no part of this. We do not support this. What we are, as Boris Johnson told Zelensky, we are in it for the long run. In other words, they were ready to back Ukraine to fight a long war against Russia, but they were not ready to back Ukraine to make peace with Russia on terms that it worked out with Russia. So, you know, the role that the US and the UK played was obviously extremely unhelpful and unsupportive of peace in Ukraine.
How have the actions of the U.S. and its allies acted in favor of or against democracy in Ukraine since 1991 or 2014?
Yeah, well, as in the rest of Western Europe, I'm sorry, Eastern Europe and the former Soviet Union, the West sent neoliberal economic advisors to advise these emerging independent countries in the case of Ukraine and Russia, really. And they went through what was called at the time economic shock therapy. And in both Russia and Ukraine, that led to such a massive shrinkage of the economy and the looting of the country's economic assets by a new class of what we now call oligarchs, who had been really the managers of the state-owned industries of those countries before that. And they, once it was privatized, they sort of knew what had value and what didn't. And and with Western backing and sometimes with Western partners and advisors, they seized everything they could get their hands on in terms of the economic assets of those countries. The net result was so dire. It was such a massive shrinkage of those economies, possibly the largest ever economic shrinkage in peacetime anywhere in history, possibly. I mean, that's what people have called it. And even life expectancy was reduced by several years in both Russia and Ukraine. This gradual takeover of the Maidan protests by extreme right-wing forces eventually led to the armed overthrow of the Ukrainian government. U.S. Assistant Secretary Victoria Nuland said that the U.S. had invested $5 billion in so-called democracy promotion in Ukraine. She was caught in a leaked tape with the U.S. ambassador to Kyiv, basically handpicking who would become prime minister of Ukraine if they were able to get rid of Yanukovych. And so much is hidden behind the scenes, as always in these things, but the US definitely played a part in the overthrow of the Yanukovych government and in the selection of the new government. This led to anti-coup protests, to the secession of Crimea and its rejoining with Russia, and it led to civil war in the east of Ukraine. We can talk more if you like about the US role in the Minsk Accords that partially resolved the civil war, and also in the civil war itself, arming up and training up the Ukrainian forces that were fighting the civil war against the self-declared Donetsk and Luhansk People's Republics.
We are talking with Nicholas J.S. Davies about his new book with Medea Benjamin, War in Ukraine, Making Sense of a Senseless Conflict. You have a chapter on information warfare. Summarize that for us.
There's outright extreme censorship in Russia and Ukraine, and the more subtle form of censorship that we have grown used to in this country, decade by decade, as the media has become debased and corrupted. And so essentially we have reporting, even in supposedly serious newspapers like the New York Times and the Washington Post, in which it's very similar to the reporters being embedded with the U.S. forces when they rode into Iraq on U.S. Humvees, sort of attached to platoons of American troops. In which situation they could only see things from the point of view of those troops, and so all of the reporting that most Americans see is coming entirely from the Ukrainian side. And as I said before, even Western diplomats are reportedly losing patience with the overblown rhetoric that we hear every day from President Zelensky in his national TV broadcasts. One of the first things he did after the invasion was to shut down all the other independent TV stations in Ukraine. So there really only is one now, which is his station. In the US, we have seen RT, which was Russian state-owned media here, which provided an opening for a lot of alternative voices that have been marginalized by the US corporate propaganda media. So they were completely shut down, and that included a lot of people who were doing programming that had absolutely nothing to do with Russia or Ukraine. People like Chris Hedges and Lee Camp and many others, who not only had their shows canceled, but actually literally lost all the archives of their past shows when the station was shut down. In the book, we quote former U.S. ambassador to Saudi Arabia, Chaz Freeman, saying, "This war in Ukraine is the most intense information war humanity has ever seen. There are so many lies flying about that it's totally impossible to perceive the truth." And Chaz Freeman, and if this show is going out sometime later today, Chaz Freeman and Jeffrey
Sachs.
Sachs and Jeffrey Sachs will be on a Code Pink Congress Zoom interactive call tonight. And they are two of the clearest voices speaking out about the crisis in Ukraine and what needs to happen. That's Chaz Freeman and Jeffrey Sachs on Code Pink Congress tonight.
And how do you find out about that?
You can go to codepink.org and you'll find it pretty easily on the website.
And that's 7 p.m. tonight. That's basically a half hour after this broadcast ends on KKFI.
The military-industrial complex has grown not just in size but in complexity since we were warned about it by President Eisenhower in 1961. And what you see when you see a retired general speaking on CNN is, make no mistake about it, an arm of the military-industrial complex pursuing its own interests.
To the detriment of the rest of humanity.
To the detriment of everything that most Americans believe in, freedom, democracy.
You have a chapter on flirting with nuclear war. Talk about that.
Yeah. And we got a lot of help on that chapter from Alice Slater from the Nuclear Age Peace Foundation. And this is, from the very beginning after the invasion, it was clear that Western policy was completely adrift, because, Secretary Austin said in April that our goal was now to weaken Russia. This is a fantasy that you can somehow weaken Russia just enough to get it to withdraw from Ukraine, but not so much that it feels threatened to the point where it would use nuclear weapons. But that's a fantasy. Russia's nuclear weapons policy is that if it faces existential defeat, which is open to very wide interpretation, and it will be interpreted by the Russians, not by us, they will use nuclear weapons. That's what the nuclear weapons are for. That's what the US nuclear weapons are supposedly for, to in extremis prevent the fall of the US government or the invasion or destruction of the United States. That's what the Russian nuclear weapons are for. And if they are threatened with that, they will use them. The New York Times raised that in the editorial board, wrote an editorial the same day that Congress, including 100% of the Democrats, approved a $40 billion aid package for Ukraine. The New York Times editorial board penned an editorial that said, The Ukraine war is getting complicated and America isn't ready. And it asked Biden directly questions. What is the purpose? How does this end? Have we given up on a negotiated settlement? How are we now trying to defeat Russia? CBS at one point reported that as little as 30 to 40% of the weapons are actually even reaching the Ukrainians at the front, partly due to Russian military strikes, but also due to the rampant corruption in Ukraine and the existence of these neo-Nazi units who are very happy to get some weapons and put them aside for to be used at some later point for some different purpose. It is so dangerous to delude 300 million Americans. The more our government does that, the more they dig themselves into a hole where it becomes sort of almost personally counterproductive for them to actually suddenly tell the truth. We are in the situation that William Casey, Reagan's CIA director, described at Reagan's first cabinet meeting, when he was asked to speak about what he was going to do with the CIA and what the goals of the CIA would be in that administration. He said, "We will know that our disinformation campaigns have been successful when absolutely nothing that the American people believe is true." Obama saying that the US military is the greatest force for good in the world. And there are many Americans who believe that. And so that's the kind of thing that Casey was talking about. And those disinformation campaigns have been successful.
So after the Soviet Union collapsed in 1991, it came out that that Soviet radars once falsely reported a U.S. nuclear first strike against the Soviet Union in 1983 that reportedly came very close to initiating a nuclear Armageddon. Compare that with the current war in Ukraine.
Well, absolutely. I would say that our currency, that at that point, our existence was saved by one Russian officer who, in fact, correctly, instead of following his standing orders to initiate a nuclear response when he saw what he saw on his computer, he logged it as a computer error. And that was, in fact, what it was. Eisenhower had begun negotiations for what became the Partial Test Ban Treaty. And after the Cuban Missile Crisis, that eventually became the first nuclear treaty between the US and the USSR. And it was the first of many. They gradually created a framework of treaties that were designed to sort of maintain this balance of terror in which neither side would deliberately launch a nuclear strike, knowing that the other side would retaliate in kind and we'd all be dead. Many of those treaties have since been dismantled. Every time any president provides a senior job to John Bolton, he knocks off another one or two of these treaties. And that was the case under Bush with the framework agreement that had actually completely curtailed North Korea's nuclear weapons program, and under Bush, he also knocked down the anti-ballistic missile treaty, which unleashed sort of this whole U.S. program to build these so-called nuclear missile defenses, which continue to this day. And then when Trump brought Bolton back in again. He knocked down the JCPOA and the open skies and the INF treaty with Russia. So, John Bolton has been more successful at, taking steps towards destroying the world than the entire rest of the US government has been in trying to save us from mass destruction.
What would you like our audience to do about the war in Ukraine and crudely related issues of national defense and foreign policy?
Well, we just really need to support. We need to, I work with Code Pink. We're part of a coalition called Peace in Ukraine with Veterans for Peace and some Peace Action affiliates and other peace groups around the US. And we need to work together and we need to build a movement to demand peace in Ukraine through diplomacy and negotiations. President Zelensky, while he is talking tough to the point of absurdity, he has shown in the past that he can turn on a dime, as he did in April, from negotiations to endless war and back again. In March 2021, he initiated an escalation of the civil war and even started moving forces towards Crimea. His military chief of staff told him that taking back Crimea and Donbass by force would inflict unacceptable military and civilian casualties on Ukraine.
We have 20 seconds left. Any final words for our audience?
Yes, please help us bring peace to Ukraine, and please read our book and learn a bit more about this absolutely unnecessary and tragic crisis.
And go to codepink.org at 7 p.m. this evening, half hour after this broadcast, and join the virtual Congress.
It's Code Pink Congress. It's chaired by Marcy Winograd out in California, and her guests tonight are Jeffrey Sachs and former Ambassador Chaz Freeman.
Nicholas J.S. Davies has been telling us about the current war in Ukraine, documented in his new book with Badia Benjamin, War in Ukraine, Making Sense of a Senseless Conflict, published by OR Books, which is the only place I found that offers a Kindle edition. Tune in next week to hear Drs. Hawkinson and Satterwhite discuss the current triple-demic of COVID, flu, and respiratory syncytial virus. Hawkinson is the medical director for the Infection Prevention and Control Program for the University of Kansas Health System. Satterwhite is the health administrator for Region 7 of the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services, which serves Iowa, Nebraska, Missouri, and Kansas. I'm Spencer Graves. Thanks for listening.